23. They didn't have the scotch. Or at least, Caro didn't. She needed, all at once, to be alone. In her room, she locked the door, lowered the blinds, and tried to order her thoughts. So much was coming at her at once. Then Clarby's theft, her unexpected conversations with Trevor, her and Barbara's soaring hopes for their journal article, and now Lorraine. Although, why was she so agitated about Lorraine? Nothing really had happened, except that a very extroverted woman had been in a quieter mood. Everybody had those, and experienced a moment of spiritual reflection. So what? She was lying to herself, and she knew it. What she didn't know, didn't understand, was what had happened to Lorraine. And she didn't like not knowing. What exactly had occurred? How? Why? Those were the questions Caro's medical training had taught her to ask about the brain. She didn't like not having answers. She especially didn't like that the answers she didn't have seemed somehow tied to the question Julian had asked the first time she'd met him. How would you like to live forever? As what? As a disembodied spirit floating in Lorraine's nothingness that was everything? No, thank you. But Lorraine, like Caro, was a scientist, a mathematician. In contrast to her over-the-top sexy clothing and flamboyant manner, her psych profile was stable, productive, logical. But she wouldn't be the first woman to have covered up feelings of social awkwardness with its opposite, an ill-calculated theatricality. Especially if, like her brother, she had a high sex drive. None of that fit with a religious conversion. If what Caro had just witnessed actually was a religious conversion. Caro and Barbara would go painstakingly over the brain mapping from Lorraine's one-minute hallucination. But Caro suspected the mapping wouldn't differ from her first session. No pronounced activity in the brain centers associated with religious ideation. It seemed to Caro that Trevor had been right when she'd asked him about his blog post on Christianity. Religion reflected humanity's need to codify natural impulses of curiosity about nature and a desire for order, plus perhaps gratitude for life itself. Start with feelings, and then build up around it beliefs and strictures that got thicker and thicker, like layers of nacre around a grain of sand. You ended up with rigid laws. Cover your hair. No meat on Fridays. Sit this way during meditation, even if it hurts your spine. Build points on roofs to keep out evil spirits, or else. The original impulse to worship life was smothered in rules and fear. Had Lorraine stripped all that away, with her vaguely mythic oneness? Or was her hallucination dictated by her familiarity with Weigert's physics, which insisted time and space are tools of the mind instead of hard physical realities? A suggestible mind might have been strongly swayed by Weigert's brilliance and conviction. Or, a third possibility. Had Lorraine created a unified and kindly universe from some need of her own? Something that hadn't been in her psych profile? Had Lorraine's lucid dreaming illusion come from Freudian need? Of all her medical training, Caro had most disliked her psych rotation. She'd chosen neurosurgery partly because it dealt with something tangible, the 3-pound mass of electrochemical machinery that was a brain. Solid. Real. All at once, she wanted even more solid reality. She phoned Ellen.
Ellen? How are you all?
We're good. Is everything all right there? You sound a little weird.
I'm fine. Tell me what you're doing right now, this very minute.
Well, I'm hanging Angelica's things on the drying rack set up in the living room because the dryer's broken and it's raining outside. Angie is asleep. Kayla is doing homework at the table. It's... Kayla, what's your homework? Aunt Caro wants to know.
The house was so small that Caro could hear Kayla's answer without Ellen repeating it.
Math! Fractions! I hate fractions!
Caro shouted,
You're right! Fractions are terrible! Let everything stay whole!
Ellen said, Jesus, Caro! You just broke my eardrum! And everybody needs fractions. What if... This was clearly for Kayla's benefit. We had to divide a loaf of bread.
Let them eat cake, Caro said.
What?
Never mind. It's just good to hear your voice. What are you making for dinner?
Meatloaf?
I love meatloaf.
Since when? You're acting very strange, sissy.
This is a strange place. I miss you all so much.
They chatted a few minutes more until Angelica woke. Caro could hear the wailing. She ended the call, refreshed by the dose of mundane, tangible, everyday normalcy. It didn't last. Caro's thoughts would accept no discipline. They shot back to Lorraine, like a dog after a squirrel. Would Lorraine's hallucination, conversion, insight, whatever, stay with her? It could be merely a temporary high, even though nothing in her or Julian's brain imaging indicated any involvement of the addiction center. Lorraine herself had said that she'd been gone for all time, even though her session had lasted for less than a minute. Caro's own childhood session in the garden had also felt both instantaneous and eternal. She had postponed George's lecture about time once, twice, thrice, but it seemed that the concept of time was more intimately bound up with consciousness than Caro had realized. She went in search of George.
The thing you have to understand about time, Caroline, is that it doesn't really exist.
Caro said, Always good to lead with a right hook.
I beg your pardon.
Never mind. They walked along the beach at Spot Bay. Caro had found George signing out a jeep and invited herself along. It somehow seemed typical of George to prefer this rocky beach to the far more picturesque ones near the resort. George wore thick-soled boots, and Caro was glad she had at least changed her sandals for sneakers. She said,
Time doesn't exist?
No, at least... Not as a real objective or external thing. We only believe it does because our brain's algorithms are wired to interpret information as occurring sequentially. Otherwise, we couldn't make sense of the world at all.
I should think not, Caro said. A pebble wedged itself into her shoe. She bent to remove it. Round, worn perfectly smooth by the sea, the pebble was reality, proven mutable. But time...
Let's start with the basics, Weigert said. You know that the equations for Newton's laws of motion, Einstein's special and general relativity, quantum theory, they all function independently of the notion of the passage of time. They operate backward as easily as forward. And you also know that Einstein proved that time is relative to the observer, that there is no one definite present moment for everyone in the universe.
Caro did know these things, at least in a vague way, but that was all she knew about physics and time. He continued,
So since the so-called flow, or arrow, of time has direction in physics, what makes us believe that it moves forward like an arrow? Three things: motion, the second law of thermodynamics, and dinosaurs. Motion first. Do you know who Zeno of Elea was?
Ancient Greek philosopher, Caro said.
Yes, 5th century BC.
He said that nothing can be in two places at once, obviously. So an arrow flying through the air occupies only one place at any given moment. At that moment, it is therefore at rest. Thus, motion is really just a series of separate events. Not a continuous one. Time isn't a feature of the external world. It's a projection of something within our minds as we tie together things we're observing. Caro frowned. But we all age. That's time. That is a series of events, too, that we interpret as time. It's just an idea in a person's mind, no more than a collection of thoughts, each of which occurs in the present moment. So it shouldn't come as a surprise that time has no existence as a separate entity. Time, as we conceive of it, is change, and only observers can experience change. Without observers, there is not even any reality to begin with. The reason we experience growing older is that we observers have memory and can only remember events observed in the past. Quantum mechanical trajectories, future to past, are associated with erasing memory, since any process that decreases entropy, any decline in order, leads to the decrease of entanglement between our memories and observed events. In other words, if we were to experience the future, we wouldn't be able to store the memories. You can't go back in time without that information being erased from your brain. By contrast, if you experience the past, the usual route of past leads to present leads to future, then you accumulate memories and nothing violates the law. So a brainless observer doesn't experience time, or a world in which we age. And it's not just because you don't experience things if you lack a brain. It actually goes deeper than that. The arrow of time, indeed, time itself, simply doesn't come into existence at any level in the first place. Aging is, truly, all in your head. You, Caroline, are young in one now, and you will experience wrinkles and graying hair in another now. But in reality, they all exist in superposition. Think of it like one of those old phonographs. Listening to the music doesn't alter the record itself. Depending on where the needle is, you hear a certain song. This is the present. The music before and after the song is the past and the future. In like manner, every moment endures in nature always. The record doesn't go away. All nows, like all songs on the record, exist simultaneously, although we can only experience it piece by piece. That superposition is why Einstein said the distinction between past, present, and future is only a stubbornly persistent illusion. But, Caro said, and wasn't sure what to say next. Barbara and Molly had made the same arguments, although less technically, and she hadn't known what to say then either. Weigert had stopped walking and, framed by the ocean, stood gazing at her with so much excitement about his own explanations that affection for him rushed over her. Affection, however, was not understanding. He said, "Consider dreams or drug experiences. During those, you are the only observer. Your consciousness can construct reality any way at all. Don't your dreams construct space and time in weird ways?"
"Yes, but dreams aren't real.
They aren't our consensus reality. But they show that your mind constructs its own time when freed of the algorithms hardwired into your conscious brain. More evidence that time is an emergent property of consciousness. Now, consider the second law of thermodynamics." Caro hoped he wasn't going to ask her to define it. She was pretty sure it had to do with decay, but was fuzzy on the details. "The second law of thermodynamics," Weigert said, walking again and waving his arms, "says that when energy changes from one form to another form, or matter moves freely, entropy in a closed system increases. Differences in temperature, pressure, and density even out horizontally, evolving toward thermodynamic equilibrium. Total entropy can never decrease over time for an isolated system." He turned to face Caro. "In other words, ice cubes don't unmelt. You don't get younger, and the universe eventually runs down." "Yes,"
Caro said, relieved that he'd said something she could agree with.
But, interestingly,
Ludwig Boltzmann, who created the laws of thermodynamics, didn't believe that entropy proved the existence of time. Using statistical mechanics, he pointed out that there are a huge number of states in which those ice cubes can exist, and nearly all of them are disordered, full of entropy. A state in which ice cubes don't melt at all is only one state, and statistically, the chances of observing it are infinitesimally small. Entropy is merely a fact of statistical behavior. So we see a lot of disordered states, and the algorithms in our consciousness interpret that as time. He smiled whimsically. Unless, of course, you just took those mushroom thingies and see the ice cubes unmelt. Caro would bet her life that George Weigert had never taken magic mushrooms, or possibly anything stronger than aspirin. Weigert talked next about why the laws of quantum gravity and the decoherence of the wave function describing the universe were inadequate to explain the emergence of time. Caro, who'd never supposed that quantum gravity did explain time, got lost in terminology. She found herself again when Weigert reached his conclusion, for which he again stopped and faced her. So you see, my dear, the emergence of the arrow of time is related to the ability of observers to remember information about what they observed. If you lack a brain, as, for instance, a rock, then time does not exist for you in the first place. Time is a relational concept, one event relative to another. Before and after have no meaning without association to another point. Thus, time requires an observer with memory, since without that, you can't have the relational concept that underlies the whole idea of the arrow of time. A simple example. Your cell phone rings. But the ring doesn't happen until you compare its sound to the silence of the second before. Do you understand, Caroline? Not completely, she admitted, and seized on something he'd said minutes ago, something she could at least visualize. Dinosaurs had brains, right? Small brains. But weren't they observers? Yes. They did, and they were. I just use dinosaurs as a shorthand for geologic time. People like dinosaurs. I don't know why, but they do. Nasty beasts. Go back further, to the formation of the solar system. If there were no conscious observers, and there were not, then the sun and planets did not exist. Physical reality begins and ends with the observer. All other times and places are things we've invented, serving only to unite knowledge into a logical whole in our minds. Think of a globe in a classroom. It's merely a representation of places that are theoretically possible to visit. Until, say, Paris was actually observed, it dwelt in the sort of blurry probability state that we've discussed before. The uncollapsed wave function. Paris, the sun, the moon, dinosaur fossils. They now exist in consensus reality because consciousness created them. The collapse of the wave function is a material object's birth moment. No, wait, Caro said. There was no sun, moon, primitive earth. There is now. Geological reality is now part of our consensus reality, but it extends no further back than an entity capable of observation. She struggled to formulate her objection. But that's circular reasoning. There was no earlier existence because consciousness wasn't there to observe it, and so there existed no reality to create observers in the first place? You're going to ask the big question, aren't you? Was she? Yes, she saw it. So where did consciousness come from?
The question is actually a bit daft, since before and after have no absolute meaning independent of the observer. The question of what came before an independent observer is completely meaningless. It's like asking what's north of the North Pole, or whether death is a state of being nothing. Most people do imagine death as nothing, but the verb to be so completely contradicts nothing that you might as well announce you're going to run, not run. The question only arises from a lack of understanding of physics. I deal in equations and observations and experiments, and this is what those three things reveal. Consciousness creates the past, not the other way around. Which, incidentally, was what Stephen Hawking said too. The past, like the future, is indefinite and exists only as a spectrum of possibilities. Caro said slowly. She didn't want to offend him. I'm sorry, George, but I can't buy this explanation of time. It just doesn't make sense to me. The rest of what you've said about the primacy of the observer, well, maybe, I'm still thinking about it. But time? It passes. I've seen it pass for my entire life. Weigert smiled. Such a gentle and accepting smile that Caro had a completely irrelevant thought. His late wife was a lucky woman. But all Weigert said was, "You don't have to accept it yet. I know it's hard when your whole idea of reality gets upended. I do know." "How is your sister doing, Caroline?" She had given him updates on the legal proceedings he had paid for. He already knew that Kayla was back home. This question felt different, more personal. She said, "Ellen always sees the best side of everything. She's managing, just as she always does. Nothing breaks her." Weigert regarded Caro for a long moment before saying, "I'm glad." She was left, however, with the impression that he'd wanted to say something else but had drawn back. Upper crust British manners? His natural reticence? Whatever it was, she didn't ask. Weigert was different from Watkins or Julian. He put less value on directness and more on trust. And Caro trusted him. If she and Ellen had had a father or grandfather like Weigert, would both their lives have turned out differently? Would Ellen have not been desperate enough to make a jailbreak marriage? Would Caro be less wary of romantic involvement? No way to tell. Not unless you were George Weigert. And Caro was not that.